This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 281 was recorded July 22nd, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. 42 Macro founder and CEO Darius Dale joins me as this week's feature interview guest. When we booked Darius for today's interview, he was firmly in the inflation camp, but he just crossed over to the dark side of the force, and his models now predict disinflation in coming months. But longer term, Darius is still a secular inflationist. We'll cover inflation, deflation, and much more in today's interview. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview when Patrick's chart deck is titled Summer Doldrums.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's talk the S&P 500. We had a drop between Friday to Monday of about 150 S&P points. It seemed like the sky was falling, and we're almost right back to the highs. What's going on in your mind?
You know, I think that a lot of this was driven by increasing concern about the Delta variant of the coronavirus. And, you know, frankly, we told you on Macro Voices like a year ago, if not more than a year ago, the story here is everybody was just so preoccupied with when are there going to be the vaccines? Because the vaccines will solve everything. This is an RNA virus similar to the common flu. That means that it mutates very easily and the vaccine has to be changed and updated constantly in order to keep up with all those mutations. And it's not as easy as other types of vaccines. So it was never intelligent to expect any outcome other than exactly what we have, which is the realization that, okay, there's going to be new strains. Some of them may be resistant to the vaccines and so forth. Now, I think that there was a little bit of panic over that, but frankly, I think it was misplaced because the public sentiment is very much toward reopening the economy regardless of the health risks. And I think what we saw in both the stock market and in commodity markets was this panic of, oh my gosh, it looks like coronavirus is really going to get worse. The pandemic's not ending like everybody thought. But wait a minute, you know, we still are going to open the economy, so maybe the sell-off was not meant to be. That's the way I'm interpreting it. I think we're headed back to fresh all-time highs. We'll see what happens.
All right, well, let's move on to that U.S. dollar index, because every time the dollar seems to have at least a small intraday drop, it seems to crawl right back to the highs, and there's a bit of a uptrend, at least over the last month or more, at least since June. Do you think that can continue on the dollar?
Well, Patrick, the key in my mind is a closing print over 93.50 on the dollar index. We haven't seen that. So as far as I'm concerned, we're right at resistance levels, challenging them, and about to see what happens. Maybe we're going to have another reversal here and continue this consolidation. But a sustained move above 93.5, now that would suggest at least a pattern of higher highs and higher lows, and maybe the beginning of a serious uptrend.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because while volatility is back, the whipsaw to the downside and to the upside is pretty violent right here. What's your take on oil and how did inventory numbers come in?
Oh boy, you know, the numbers I'm looking at are margin numbers. CME Group has almost doubled margins on some crude oil positions. And I think, frankly, they do this in response to volatility because they think they're making the world a safer place. I think they add volatility by forcing people to reposition when they change the margin rules. So what caused this panic sell-off, the just dramatic sell-off? Two things, really. OPEC Plus making a deal, and then the COVID Delta variant situation. OPEC Plus has been a really interesting story for the last several weeks. We've heard narratives that say if OPEC Plus makes a deal, that means it can only be bearish. And we've heard them say if they don't make a deal, that's even more bearish. Well, that doesn't really make sense, does it? It seemed like there was just a sentiment in the market that, you know, when OPEC Plus made a deal, they were going to increase production. The sky was falling. Everybody's freaking out about the Delta variant. We got all the way down to the 100-day moving average, which I bought very aggressively. And it looks to me like we're well on the way to what I think will be a full correction and new highs. I still think over $80 on front month WTI before Labor Day. That's American Labor Day, the one in September. As far as EIA inventory, it was a surprise this week with a build on crude oil inventories of 2.1 million barrels. Of course, we were expecting another big drawdown. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 1.3 million barrels. Gasoline drawing down 121,000 barrels. Distillates drawing down 1.3 million barrels. But still, even with that big distillate drawdown, net the overall petroleum product, including both crude and finished products, was a net build, which nobody expected. Now, you'd think that would be very bearish, but the market barely even flinched and just moved higher. So I think we've had the realization that, wait a minute, OPEC's not falling apart. The action of OPEC is not massively bearish. It's actually bullish for the market. And I think we're going to see a full recovery. But, the reason I think we see a full recovery and prices up above $80 by Labor Day is because specifically I'm expecting a lot more big drawdowns on inventory. This week, maybe it was an anomaly, maybe it's a new trend. One print doesn't make a new trend, but we got to watch it carefully. Meanwhile, U.S. production ticking up to 11.4 million barrels. That's up 100,000 barrels from last year. So the predictions of some analysts that we were going to see a big drop-off in U.S. production this year, well, might still happen this year, but it's not going to happen before the end of summer driving season, which is where the real squeeze has been. So it seems like that didn't actually end up happening.
All right, well, let's move on to gold because basically we remain very trade range bound while we've seen substantial volatility in oil and the markets. Gold seems to really be crawling around and no move of any conviction. When do you think gold's going to wake up and which direction do you think it's going to go?
I can't tell you which direction, but when it's going to wake up is fairly soon. And the reason is you don't see it on the chart unless you put all the moving averages in. But what's really going on here is we're trading in back and forth with support on the short-term moving averages and resistance on the long-term moving averages. Particularly the 34-day moving average has been the one that has acted as resistance, and the 21 is acting as support. Now, they're converging. They're about to cross. It's just like a triangle pattern on a chart. It has to resolve one way or the other in the next week. I'm leaning towards up, but I don't know. If it's going to resolve down, potentially we could be looking at another big wave. If I look at the stochastics already on the low side, says to me we got a few more days and hopefully we see a breakout, but we need above 1840 to really persuade me that, and that's a sustained move above 1840, to persuade me that the bull trend is back on again.
All right, and let's wrap up with touching on this 10-year Treasury yield, because bonds continue to rally and yields continue to decline. I mean, we were well under 1.20 earlier at the start of the week. I mean, we've now rebounded. We're trading at the time of recording around 1.26. What's your take here on Treasury yields? You think the bond rally can continue?
Well, even back up to 1.26, that's well below 1.34, which we talked about last week as being a potential resistance level in price or support level in yield. And that didn't happen. So it seems like that's not going to be a technical level that's going to slow down this trend of lower bond yields. And I think that basically we had a big scare over the amount of money that the Biden administration was going to spend. And just as we predicted on Macro Voices, once people really thought that through and figured out that, wait a minute, the Fed's going to monetize most of this anyway. I think we're back down to calming down again. So the market, unless we get another move up above 1.7%, I think we're going to see a fairly docile and not too interesting bond market in the next few weeks.
This week's feature interview guest is 42 Macro founder Darius Dale. Now, Eric, why did we invite Darius back on the show this week?
Well, Darius is a really smart macro guy, and he's a model-driven guy. And what I find most interesting about this whole macro situation that we face is, I'm really convinced of my secular inflation view, but it kind of feels to me like it's gone too far too fast. And boy, I don't want to add to that reflation or inflation trade at these lofty levels, because it just feels to me like maybe it's time for a pullback. I think, as you'll see in this interview, Darius has got a much more objective and data-driven view in which he's going to say, basically, yeah, he's still a secular inflationist, but not for the next year or so. So I don't want to steal his thunder. Let's leave the rest for the interview with Darius.
Eric's interview with Darius is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This
This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Abex Technologies. In addition to sponsoring Macro Voices, Abex also produces Smarter Markets, a weekly podcast that airs every Saturday morning on all the major podcast platforms. Smarter Markets brings together the leading minds in macroeconomics, technology, and commodities to explore how capital markets can be redesigned to better serve market participants and society as a whole. Michelle Dennity's five-part series about the role of digital innovation in advancing the ESG economy is live now at smartermarketspod.com, and you can look for another terrific interview every Saturday morning. But you won't get Smarter Markets on your Macro Voices feed. You have to subscribe separately to Smarter Markets in your podcast app in order to listen to this free podcast.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Darius Dale, founder and CEO of 42 Macro. Darius prepared an extremely complete chart deck for today's interview. I strongly recommend that you download it. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to the homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button that says looking for the downloads. We're going to be referring to the slides in that deck. We're not going to have time for all of them, but I encourage you to go through all of them at your leisure because it's a really great deck. Darius, I want to start with a story which, you know, when we booked you for this, we said, listen, buddy, we're really looking for a deflationist because we've had so many secular inflationists, including myself. We want to offset that with an opposing view. And you said, sorry, I'm a model-driven guy and my model says inflation. Then something changed because I got an email from you just a couple hours before we did this interview on Tuesday morning, and you said you might get your deflationist after all. What did you mean?
Hey, thanks, Eric. It's great to be back. So in terms of what changed, we run this dynamic factor model that we use to nowcast what we call the dominant market regime, or what we believe or how we believe investors should be orienting their risk management exposure. As we show on slide 6 through 13, that system, and it's born out of 42 market indicators that we're scoring through the lens of our volatility adjusted momentum signaling process, that system finally tipped in favor of deflation as of this morning, Tuesday, July 20th.
Now, is that something that, you know, tips back and forth every couple of days, or is this something that, tends to only give you a signal every, you know, few years or so?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So it pretty much lines up with the rate of change cycle for growth and inflation. So taking a step back, you know, looking at the slide deck on slide 3, we outline the sort of regime segmentation process that we use to measure and map the bottom up macro regime cycle. And we're looking at this through the lens of the trending rate of change of growth, which we measure through the OECD CLI indexes. And we're looking at this through the trending rate of change of headline CPI. And so ultimately, in terms of how often the system signals a change in the state of the markets, which we believe are ultimately just pricing in those trending rates of change, growth, and inflation, you know, that happens two and a half times per year where you really get a meaningful shift in that system. So, you know, a couple times a year, on average, 2 to 3 times a year, investors really do have to reorient their risk management posturing, i.e. what they're buying dips in, what they're selling rips in, how much cash do they have, how much, you know, leverage and credit risk are they taking it in and across the portfolio. So we got that signal this morning, and, you know, who knows how persistent it's likely to be, but I can make a case, a very strong case, that it's likely to be persistent for at least a few months.
Now, on page 3, it appears that this whole slide here is telling me I want to choose which one of these 4 possible places I am on your grid. So we just said we moved from increasing inflation to decreasing inflation, so we must be on the left half. Are we on the top or the bottom? Because I don't know how you're measuring the trend in growth, whether it's still accelerating or not, or how do you measure that?
Yeah, actually, a better slide to see that would actually be slide 25. This is showing our United States grid outlook through the lens of that regime segmentation system. And as you can see, we've been in a state of trending acceleration from an economic growth perspective since going all the way back to July of 2020. In fact, the economy bottomed in April of 2020, but it wasn't until July that we actually started to record a trending acceleration. Our model has that trending acceleration projected to culminate in August next month, followed by a sequence of 6 to 7 deflationary months from the perspective of this model. Now, when I say deflation, I don't mean outright year-over-year price declines. It's really just a nomenclature associated with the confluence of trending deceleration in both growth and inflation.
Okay, now I just have to, you know, when I look at a chart like this, boy, we went to, it seems like the center of the chart where these two axes intersect is kind of the mean. What a huge deviation there was out to, it looks like May of 21 was kind of where we got to almost the extreme of your scale there on the right-hand side. What does that mean? Why was there such a deviation, and was that a trend reversal, or how do we interpret that?
Great question, Eric. So the x-axis shows the trending acceleration or deceleration in inflation. And so being that positively skewed on the chart to the right side obviously implies there was a meaningful acceleration in inflation. It's actually easier to see in time series format on slide 28, where we show the secular view on U.S. inflation, and then we zoom in to show the cyclical view on U.S. inflation. And sort of there's two key takeaways I'd make on this chart. One, we've clearly broken out of the post-crisis era sort of secular in terms of the stationary mean of inflation. We're significantly higher than that. We're obviously higher than most economists' expectations, at least heading into the last few months. And the second point I'd like to make is that our models, and we run two models simultaneously. One's called our stationary mean reversion model. It obviously implies stationary mean reversion is the framework. And then we run a second model called our agent-based nowcast model. And then we split the difference between the two to formulate the basis of our growth and inflation projections. As you can see from the chart on the right, we have inflation decelerating or disinflating really starting in July throughout the balance of our projection period, which extends all the way into the middle of next year.
Now, obviously, you could have a little blip down that wouldn't mean anything, but you're interpreting this as a trend change. What do you use in order to measure that? Is it like a trend following moving average thing, or how do you decide when there's actually been a reversal of direction and a movement of these charts?
Yeah, so I mean, it's a confluence of cyclical momentum, sequential momentum, and the associated buildup or dissipation therein, and it's also a confluence of the mean reversion towards that stationary mean. Now, I will say this about the time series. I have a belief, if you can consider me a longer term inflationist, I'm a shorter term disinflationist, but I do believe the stationary mean of the U.S. inflation time series broadly, core PCE, headline inflation, core inflation, things of that nature, have transposed themselves higher relative to where they were in the post-crisis era. If you look at headline CPI, for example, the stationary mean of that time series really from 09 or really started 2010 up until the end of 2019 was somewhere around 1.5%. If you look at the chart on the right again on slide 28, in terms of where we're likely to bottom in the middle of next year on inflation, it's very likely that we start to reaccelerate in the back half of 2022 from an inflation perspective, but we're going to be reaccelerating from levels that are much higher than you traditionally would start to reaccelerate from. I mean, it implies a stationary mean of about 3% now for U.S. headline CPI relative to a stationary mean of about 1.5% in the post-crisis era. So that's a big deal longer term. I just don't know that investors have to price that in today.
Now, I want to make sure I'm understanding this because it really resonated for me, but I could be grasping at straws here and trying to put my own view on this. I personally am very much a secular inflation guy long term, and I'm not smart enough to figure out short term. I think what you're telling me is we just had the first wave of the secular inflation, which I expect to take a full decade to play out, if not more. You're saying it looks like that first wave is ending, but it sounds to me like you're also saying you see the second wave coming just like I do. Did I get that right?
You nailed that, Eric. Thank you for understanding that. It's really about the sequence of events. I think a lot of investors are brilliant and they really focus on the destination or the outcome. And I do believe that's important if you're a long-term strategic asset allocator. However, if you're like most of us who, eat food and breathe air and go to sleep, we have to worry about the sequence along the way because the sequence is obviously ultimately where our P&L is derived from. And in terms of getting to that second wave of inflation, it's very likely that we have to actually work through a meaningful acceleration in base effects and a meaningful deceleration in economic activity, between sort of, let's call it September of this year, October of this year, and really all the way through the middle of next year.
So on page 25, obviously some of these plot points that you're showing are in the future. So they're projections, not current data. And you go all the way out to June of 22. So it sounds like if I'm a secular inflation guy, you're telling me that probably through the middle of 22, I'm going to be having opportunities to get that second chance to buy copper and other things that would have been inflation hedge trades that have just gone too far too fast to be getting on them now. Does that make sense? And how else should I, as a secular inflationist, be thinking about the opportunity? If you're right in this model, you're basically saying, I got a second chance to get in at the bottom before the next inflation runs away, and I probably got plenty of time to take action. Is that the way I should interpret this, or how do you advise your clients in terms of what they do with this information if they have a long-term secular inflation view?
Yeah, I mean, the starters, I mean, so whenever you talk about going into a deflation market regime, again, we highlight the market regime signals, probabilities, and the dominant market regime on slides 11, 12, and 13. Whenever you go into a deflation market regime, it obviously sort of implies that investors should be taking down their risk to cyclical assets. At 42 Macro, we call that high grading your exposure. So within the equity market, you're getting into more size, you're decreasing the earnings volatility of the types of stocks you buy in, you're downshifting your beta. You know, in the credit markets, you're obviously, you know, sort of going up the capital structure and in on the credit spectrum, and obviously buying duration, allocating to gold, allocating to the dollar, the yen, the Swiss franc. So that's sort of your traditional deflation playbook. Now, obviously, if you're a secular inflationist, as I tend to be, just going back to our stationary mean reversion discussion, you know, that means a lot of the stuff that you believe in longer term is likely to sell off and or experience a trending bout of volatility. So you can buy put exposure against that, although I would argue that view is widely shared by most market participants. If you look at slide 23, what we show on that slide on the left chart is the relationship between sort of the near-term at-the-money put implied volatility versus the near-term realized volatility regime or the local volatility regime. And, you know, across the board for most sectors, style factors, commodities, and you know, sort of major macro exposures, there's just a tremendous amount of put premium out there in the market today. So either one of two things has to happen. The market has to go down a lot to realize all that put premium, or the market has to melt up because dealers have to cover those hedges if we don't actually see that realized volatility. Obviously, the transition to deflation from a market regime perspective implies that the probability of realizing all that volatility is much higher than it was prior to today.
Darius, I'm feeling this confluence of different factors because on the one hand, you're a model-driven guy. You're telling me your model, your signals are telling you very clearly we're headed into a deflationary or disinflationary regime. But you're also telling me that you're a long-term secular inflation kind of guy, despite the fact your model says the opposite in the shorter term. So why do you think that in the longer term? I mean, I've got my reasons, but I'd like to hear yours. And how do you navigate this when your model is telling you, at least for now, that long-term view is not ready to happen yet?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I do believe that we are well on the path towards realizing that long-term view. However, the path is not going to be linear, and we have to deal with decelerating economic activity, decelerating inflation, you know, for at least a year until getting to that second wave that we discussed. You know, so as it relates to what, from my perspective, what drives asset markets from a longer term, you know, headwind or tailwind perspective, I think there's four main secular forces in the economy that investors either have to risk manage or they're being forced to risk manage. Number one, I think, or this is no particular order, but number one, that's demographics. That's on slide 34. We look at that through the lens of the five-year-old old age dependency ratio relative to the working age population, that five-year forward CAGR. So demographics are still where they are. That hasn't changed. So that's disinflationary. On slide 35, we show the balance of payments risk. On the x-axis, we show the current account balance as a percent of GDP. On the y-axis, we show the sovereign fiscal balance as a percent of GDP. So as you can see where the U.S. dot is, all the way down there to the left, we have a lot of secular pressure on the dollar. It's a major headwind to the U.S. dollar from a flows perspective. So that's something that we certainly think needs to be ironed out. And more importantly, I think the real key takeaway from this slide, and not to make your listeners jump around, I think that the most important takeaway from the slide is that somebody's got to finance these budget balances, whether it comes from foreign demand, you know, in terms of, you know, the dollar recycling that we demonstrate on slide 54, not again, making your listeners jump around. On slide 54, we show sort of the trend in dollar recycling on in terms of foreign central bank assets relative to treasuries, relative to U.S. debt. That's obviously been straight down and to the right for an extended period of time. So that means the Fed really has to step in, if you look at slide 55, to incrementally finance all that public debt. Now, the issue with that, if you jump again to slide 57, you know, the issue with that is it doesn't seem like this Federal Reserve has really sort of bought into the MMT, you know, really transitioned to MMT. And part of the reason, obviously, is we haven't seen a tremendous amount of turnover on the FOMC. But I also think the cyclical inflation pressure is really spooking some of the Fed officials that would otherwise be on board with such a transition. And the reason I bring that up is because when you look at terminal Fed funds rate expectations through the lens of five-year forward overnight index swap spreads, you know, those have plummeted since the end of March. I mean, we're talking about down a full percent. And to me, that move down a full percent is really, you know, and it obviously accelerated post the June FOMC. I think that is really indicative of the market saying, oh, no, wait, this is still kind of the same Fed that we're used to, right? It's obviously a little different, $120 billion of bonds a month with GDP growing, you know, 10%, you know, annualized. That's obviously a little bit different than what we saw in the post-crisis era. But in terms of their willingness to really take the cap off long-term inflation expectations and really allowing those to seep into the real economy, they haven't changed. And that's what they signaled to investors with their hawkish dot plot revision going back into the middle of June. So this likely means that we're going to have this start-stop process. If you go back one slide to slide 56, we're going to have the stop-start process in terms of how do we finance these budget deficits. So that brings me back to my point at the beginning of this discussion. You know, the treasury market sits atop the global capital structure. You know, who's going to finance all these budget deficits? Well, either the Fed's got to do it by accelerating its balance sheet purchases or at the bare minimum, not tapering, or it has to crowd out the private sector and crowding out equity issuance, crowding out corporate debt issuance, crowding out, you know, speculation in other assets, just so that you could sort of feed the beast, if you will.
Darius, I'd love to understand your perspective longer term, because the way I see this is, you know, you just said, looks like the MMT crowd has not taken over the government yet. I agree. They haven't yet, with an underscore on yet. The way I read the politics, I think it's coming. And I think that we're headed toward a situation where younger generations are really going to push back on the boomer generation and say, look, we don't like your systems and your rules and we're changing the game. So, you know, that doesn't happen overnight. I really see that's where it's headed. Am I on the same page as you are? Or do you see this differently? What's your long-term view of where we're going?
Yeah, no. So if I have one long-term view, it's really born out of, you know, some awesome work, you know, by guys like Neil Howe with The Fourth Turning, Peter Turchin, you know, author of The Ages of Discord, in terms of sort of the historical political response to these types of setups in the economy and in society. If you look at slide 37, so, you know, rounding out the secular drivers that really impact asset markets, on slide 36 is the leverage cycle, which we look at through the lens of private non-financial sector credit to GDP on a 3-year Z-score basis, and also through the lens of the private non-financial sector debt service ratio on a 3-year Z-score basis. That's a mouthful, but the key takeaway when you just glance at this slide is that, you know, a lot of economies, including the United States of America, have really levered up to combat this cycle from a private non-financial sector credit perspective. So that implies that we're going to have a real tough time sustaining an economic expansion in the absence of a tremendous amount of incremental stimulus. And I think we're going to find that out. And maybe Biden is aware of this. I doubt it. But certainly it seems in terms of the panic that they're, you know, perpetuating out of that side of the aisle in DC, it seems to suggest that they're well aware that they got to do more to keep this game going. And that brings me to my final secular driver, which I think is the most relevant one to the discussion between secular inflation and secular deflation. On slide 37 here, we just show the x-axis, the Gini coefficient. Your listeners will know what that is. It's a measure of income inequality. Higher is more unequal. And then the y-axis, we show the headline unemployment rate. Well, if you can just, you know, see where the U.S. dot is north of 40 on the Gini and right around 6 on the unemployment rate, you know, we're sort of hanging out with emerging market economies now. We're no longer down at the bottom left of this chart, which is where you would expect to be as one, as a major superpower, but certainly as a developed market economy in today's setup. So the fact that our dot is there, in my opinion, is really perpetuating a lot of the zeitgeist that you see out there from both sides of the aisle in terms of, hey, we're getting a raw deal. Hey, we're getting screwed. I mean, you had protests in the street in last summer, and then you had protests in the Capitol from the other side of the aisle, you know, this winter. I mean, there's a clear amount of anger and frustration out there in the U.S. society. And part of it, in my opinion, is driven by, on slide 38, the breakdown in the social contract. And so what I'm showing here on slide 38 is the blue line shows employee compensation as a percent of gross value added. The red line shows corporate profits as a percent of nominal GDP. And as you can see, just in terms of where those lines, those respective plots had trended, you know, really for 50, 60 years prior to 2000, you know, we've really turned that on its head in the last couple of decades. And obviously, we've got some pretty key drivers of that transition. You got globalization, you know, China joining the WTO in 2001. You've obviously had the proliferation of the internet and the digital economy and all the disinflation that's brought relative to wages. And then you've also had a lot of industry consolidation born out of, you know, the private equity bubble. And so, you know, there's a lot of people out there that feel angry and frustrated. And I think they are aware of that transition. And this is my opinion why we're seeing such bipartisan support for trillion-dollar budget deficits. Obviously, going back to Trump, you know, he proved that this sort of concept of fiscal conservatism in the U.S., particularly born out of, you know, the right side of the political spectrum, was really dying. And part of the reason it was dying is because, you know, I think we you know, poor people from the left really migrated to the right, because at the end of the day, it wasn't really about, you know, Republicans versus Democrats. It was about populists versus austerists, or if I'm even, I'm not sure if I'm saying that word correct, but I think people know what I mean. Were you going to be austere? You're going to be populist. And I think that's the real big transition in the economy. So you have that from a political perspective, but then you also have on slide 40, a lot of the secular drivers of disinflation are still intact. You know, the labor force participation rate is still obviously hampered by demographics. The velocity of money is still on its lows relative to a 30, 40, 50 year time series. And then on slide 41, you know, corporate America continues to be dominated by monopsonies and a broad-based preference for capital expenditures over labor. The blue line shows the market cap of the S&P 100 relative to the S&P 500. That's up and to the right. The red line shows the compensation of employees relative to CapEx, and that's down and to the right. So a lot of these drivers are still intact, but ultimately, in terms of how we think it resolves itself, we ultimately think the 2020 election was no fluke. We're certainly moving in a direction where populism is not only sort of welcome, but it's cheered on by both sides of the aisle. And I think, you know, Mitch McConnell's going to have a tough time next fall if he doesn't understand that.
Darius, that covers the inflation view. Let's bring it to monetary policy. What's going to happen? Because, you know, in theory, the way this is supposed to work is when we get inflation, central bankers respond by increasing interest rates. Seems to me it really is different this time in the sense that they're really not able to increase interest rates the way Paul Volcker did in the 80s, because they just don't have room without bankrupting the federal government through its borrowing cost. So I feel like we've got this inflation trap that we're setting central bankers up for, where they're going to get to the point where their hands are tied and they say, we can't print money to solve this problem because that exacerbates the inflation, and they're screwed. Am I right to think there's a trap there? And what do you think is coming in terms of central bank policy?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And this is part of the, for my, I think you hit the nail on the head in terms of why that trap is maybe why our market regime signaling process is transitioned to deflation. I think asset markets are starting to figure out that if they did have a sniffle as a function of the Delta variant, as a function of decelerating growth and inflation, as a function of any sort of headwinds on fiscal policy or incremental fiscal stimulus, that the Fed can't necessarily step in and accelerate its pace of purchases. In fact, it might actually have to be sort of stepping into a tapering process, you know, into and during a market decline, which is obviously extremely anomalous relative to you know, sort of, you know, how Fed policy, the reaction function has historically worked. So in terms of that, you know, kind of ironing that all out, jumping to slide 44, there's obviously
hang on one
no
second before
evidence.
We move on. I want to go back to that because, wait a minute, you are saying that you think the Fed would actually taper into a market decline, because I, at the risk of being cynical, I feel like for the last few years, if there's anything we've proven, it's that the Fed will basically do anything to bail the market out. I don't think that's just or right or the way it should be, but it seems like it's the way it is. Why would you think it would be different now?
No, I actually don't think it'll be different, but I think the markets need to find that out. And that to me is the scary part about, you know, from the perspective of investor consensus, that's the scary part about having a five handle on inflation. Is we don't actually know. And more importantly, we don't actually know what to look for in terms of the Fed's new mandates. I mean, they obviously have a new average inflation targeting mandate. They have a new sort of maximum and inclusive, you know, emphasis on inclusive employment mandate. And so the reality is, I don't think the average investor, myself included, really understands, you know, what does it take to actually achieve and accomplish those mandates. And quite frankly, I think Powell's done a masterful job of explaining to investors and policymakers that, hey, we don't know either. We're kind of, you know, kind of feeling our way out on this as well. So ultimately, I just think that, you know, asset markets, if we're going into a regime where investors are going to start to receive broad signals from both economic data and other market participants, that we should have a risk off tone and discipline to our risk management. I think that there's a risk that feeds upon itself for at least a couple of months, because, again, we're not going to see a Federal Reserve that's going to be brazen enough at the early onset of that downturn, that market volatility, to say, hey, no, we got your back, you know, we're going to hold your hand. And that to me is a potentially a big deal for asset markets, at least, you know, in terms of the next 2 to 3 months.
Thanks for clarifying that, Darius. I think you were talking about cyclical forces in the economy before I interrupted you.
Yeah, of course. So, you know, just a few charts in that, you know, on slide 42, this is something I have a firm belief in is that, you know, one, we already have, you know, lower highs and lower lows and economic surprise indices. And obviously, you know, going back to Friday's University of Michigan Consumer Confidence Report, you know, that was kind of the most recent in a series of sort of negative economic surprises. And I certainly think that's something that has the potential to persist throughout the back half of the year. If you look at slide 43, we have growth expectations, you know, meaningfully elevated. You know, we're still tracking at 6.6% for 21 and then 4.2%. We actually ticked up the most recent data point for 2022. Well, the problem with those expectations being as elevated as they are in the confluence of a simultaneous deceleration in growth and inflation, it means that investor consensus, and what I mean by that, or sorry, not investor consensus, economist consensus and analyst consensus is very unlikely to take their numbers down, you know, sort of by a meaningful enough degree to have a real reset, which means that if we do start to see some trending asset market volatility, you know, more declines in the stock market, more declines in risk assets broadly, you know, it's going to be met with confirmation that, okay, the economic outlook, you know, certainly relative to very lofty expectations is deteriorating. So that to me is, it's almost like we have this sort of air pocket of no more good news out of the economy from a rate of change perspective. We're not going to get bailed out, at least not in the near term, by the Fed. And oh, by the way, fiscal policy could potentially be setting up to disappoint to the extent that the Republicans don't play ball and you actually have one or two Democratic senators defect.
Okay, Darius, how much downside could we be looking at here?
So I'll start by saying I think it's pretty aggressive to have price targets in general. I mean, I think you know, anyone managing money, even their own money, realizes that price targets are a fool's errand in this business. But you know, I have been anchoring on the 2009-2010 analog because I believe it's a really good sort of, you know, sort of, not only does it the price chart analog look really good, but it also makes a lot of sense from a bottom-up macro regime perspective as well. So if you look at slide 59, what we're doing is we're overlaying the 2009 experience of the S&P 500 relative to the red line, which is the, you know, sort of 2020 to 2021 experience. And what you can see is that, okay, both plots bottomed in March. That was sort of the nadir of the economic deceleration that we inflected in the spring of both years and accelerated for over a year from that point forward. And then ultimately, you know, the blue line, the 2010 example, started to sell off as the rate of change cycle for growth was peaking, right in line with that. And then ultimately on slide 60, we had a 16% drawdown in the stock market that, in my opinion, was a confluence of, you know, that rate of debt natural healing process off the lows of the GFC really coming to conclusion. And then you also had a termination of QE1 in March of that year. So you had a liquidity drought during summer of that year that really culminated in a 16% drawdown in the stock market. I think that's a very reasonable expectation. I mean, the setup from a bottom-up macro regime perspective is almost perfect. You know, and you also think about, you know, the setup from a top-down macro market regime perspective in terms of how policy is feeding into that. It's very likely that, you know, at the bare minimum, the Fed can't do anything else. You know, they're not going to go from $120 billion a month, 80 treasuries, 40 mortgage-backed securities to, I don't know, $150 billion a month on a 10% correction in the stock market. You know, certainly not with inflation at you know, north of 5%, you know, north of 4% for something like core PCE. That's not going to happen. So you're probably going to have to see a bigger drawdown in risk assets to really get the Fed to materially punt its policy tightening expectations into the future.
Okay, Darius, so it sounds like you're saying the Fed's in a box and you think that could result in about a 15 or 16% drawdown in the S&P with the caveat that price targets are never really that meaningful.
Yeah, no, totally. I'm just using that as a natural analog, again, based on the fundamentals and the price action really kind of agreeing with each other. So I think it's reasonable to sort of say, like, it's unlikely to see a major material drawdown, you know, something that would obviously be a bell ringer, 30, 40, 50%, like, you know, some of your guests have said in recent past. You know, I've seen analysis that would suggest that that's, you know, potentially on the tape and mostly through the lens of valuation. There's two ways we look at valuation. One is through the lens of our sort of quantitative valuation overlay. And I think so in terms of how we look at the stock market, you know, we're looking at the next 12-month PE ratio, the spread of the next 12-month PE ratio relative to the MSCI ACWI on a one-year Z-score basis. And we're right up at around 1.7. You know, this is pretty rich, you know, in terms of where U.S. equities are relative to global equities. But I also think when you look at, you know, something like, you know, the real earnings yield for the S&P 500, which is on slide 72, that number has recently declined to -2, which is, you know, right around the sort of all-time lows for this time series. And the reason I bring that up is because 5 of the last 6 times we've seen the real S&P 500 earnings yield as deflated by a headline CPI go negative, it was just on the precipice of a major correct crash in the stock market. So sort of if you look at all, you know, the kind of six or seven of the last major crashes, 5 of them have been presaged by this time series, the real earnings yield going negative, and we're deeply negative as of now. So I do believe, and you look at something like Bitcoin, which would be on slide 71, you know, at least over the last, you know, 4 years, Bitcoin has historically led, you know, major drawdowns in the stock market or things that I think investors would consider to be something they really want to risk manage ahead of time. So that to me is something that's sending a dour warning signal from a near-term perspective. And obviously the real earnings yield analysis is sending a longer-term bearish warning signal. But ultimately, I don't think that that's a likely probability. You know, I certainly don't. I don't. If I've learned anything from, you know, joining this industry in 2009 to getting to this point, is that, you know, there's just a lot of wall of worry out there, and you know that wall of worry and most recent sort of thing on the wall of worry is sort of China, right? On slide 76, we're talking about the Chinese credit impulse, and this is something we've been talking about for an extended period of time. You know, the Chinese credit impulse rolling over and leading to pressure on commodities, leading to cyclical. They're leading to pressure on Chinese assets and ultimately pressure on commodities in that order. You know, that's something that's obviously been rolling over. But again, I just don't think it's prudent to go out there and say, hey, I think the stock market's going to go down 20, 30, 40% in the context of a Fed buying $120 billion of assets a month. I think that's just crazy.
Darius, you've given me all kinds of interesting new perspectives. Let's try to assimilate all this into kind of a conclusion. What do I take away? I mean, basically, it's long-term secular inflation, except not right now, back into deflation or disinflation for a little while, but it's still coming back to inflation someday. And you know, Fed policy, we've covered a bunch of things. How do we net this down to what do investors do with their money in the next year or so?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. That's the number one thing we specialize in at 42 Macro is what to actually do with your money. You know, I don't get me wrong. There's some phenomenal investors out there who put together, you know, wonderful slide decks about the future. And it's great, but ultimately, I think if you lack the understanding of the sequence and the risk management of it all, quite frankly, the research just isn't as actionable or valuable. So we really try to focus on that. That's not to say we obviously have everything figured out or right all the time, but it certainly means it is an explicit focus of our product. Slide 14 and 15, you know, we sort of highlight, you know, the pivots investors should be making across our 4 grid regimes with respect to those market regimes. So obviously, the circle on the right shows deflation. And so as recently as a couple of hours ago, you know, we sent out a presentation to our trust prescribers that said, hey, we're pivoting to this full deflation portfolio. So that obviously it means you should be, you know, 80% in fixed income and FX and 20% in equities and commodities. And those numbers aren't arbitrary. They're obviously rounded numbers, but they're based on our grid asset market back test. So we're looking at, you know, everything that ticks through the lens of global macro, U.S. macro, U.S. exposures to understand, you know, what's the annualized expected return in a potential regime? What's the percent positive ratio, the percentile of the return, the volatility, the covariance, the n size, all those, you know, important descriptive statistics to ultimately get to, you know, those pie charts on slide 14 and 15. And so we've recently on slide 15 came out of a scenario where we were hybrid allocated for Goldilocks and deflation because we knew deflation was coming. And then as recently, again, as today, we put the full deflation playbook on. You know, out of respect for our paying subscribers, you know, I'll keep the actual, you know, sort of ETF exposure that we're highlighting and sort of the ultimate cash allocation, you know, off the record. But, you know, obviously, yeah, your listeners can come check us out.
Darius, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. Listeners, I do encourage you to peruse the entire slide deck at your leisure. It's got a lot of interesting slides. Fair enough on what you said about respecting your paying customers as far as the actual ETF allocations. Give us just the quick 60-second elevator pitch on 42 Macro. Is it just for institutional investors? Is it also available to retail? Tell us more about it.
Yeah, no, it's available to anybody who's got $50 a month to read my morning note. $50 a month to look at our weekly portfolio construction changes and $100 a month to look at our slide decks. I mean, quite frankly, you know, we obviously, you know, have partner relationships with all the major Wall Street firms and on the buy side and large RIAs, but we also spend a lot of time liaising, interacting with retail investors. You know, some of our biggest clients are, you know, just people, retired rich people. And so quite frankly, at the end of the day, what I really believe in at 42 Macro is the democratization of institutional grade macro risk management. A lot of people do macro, but they don't necessarily have a real rooted macro process for, you know, making real thoughtful portfolio construction and changes therein. So that's what we focus on at 42 Macro. I have a lot of experience with that, a lot of experience in, you know, regime segmentation and understanding those whole processes and the sequence of it all. So to the extent that sounds good for you guys, check us out. Otherwise, just we'll catch you back here on Macro Voices next time.
Well, Darius, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Escrow.com is the payment system for buying and selling anything of value. Cars, boats, airplanes, jewelry, gemstones, fine art, collectibles, intellectual property rights, domain names, bringing in shipping containers from overseas, or even buying and selling entire businesses. It's simple to use. Either party sets up the transaction, then the buyer sends the funds to Escrow.com. The seller is then instructed to send the goods to the buyer to inspect. Within the inspection period, the buyer can return the items for any reason. After that, Escrow.com pays the seller immediately. Escrow.com is the world's most secure payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. Over 2 million customers have transacted over $5 billion on Escrow.com, and eBay and Shopify use it for cars, boats, luxury watches, and business sales. It's available in the United States, Canada, and Australian dollars, euros, and British pounds. Never buy or sell anything online unless you use Escrow.com. Escrow.com is a subsidiary of Freelancer.com, listed on the OTCQX Best Markets under the ticker symbol FLNCF, and the Australian Securities Exchange under the ticker FLN.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Darius on the show. You know, one of the things that I find hardest in macro is we develop such strong biases toward our bigger picture views. And what I like about Darius is that by being data-driven and modeling, when the data changes, you have to have the flexibility to adapt your trading style. And that's really important to have that kind of a system in place. So it's really great to get Darius on, and in particular at the moment where his model is shifting like that. What did you take away from the interview?
Well, as you said at the end there, it's the fact that his model is shifting that I find so interesting, because I am convinced of the secular inflation view. I feel like these trades have moved too far too fast. It'll be crazy to just put new money into, you know, copper longs at very elevated prices. What Darius is telling us is not necessarily contradicting my long-term secular inflation view at all, but he's saying, get ready for the pullback, guys, and maybe into next summer is when we'll be looking at a return of that inflation trade. Now, I don't know if he's right or not, but I think this kind of insight is super important because it starts to give you a little bit of guidance on how to maneuver into positions in a long-term strategy if you have that long-term secular inflation view, which I definitely have. Patrick, as we navigate the summer doldrums, I want to move on to your chart deck, which happens to be titled Summer Doldrums. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click the red button that says Looking for the Downloads. Patrick, it's summer. It must be doldrums. What's going on here with the S&P on page 2?
Well, you know, you have to highlight the fact that I put a question mark at the end of it to ask whether, in fact, it will be the summer doldrums. But it is worth talking about just how this market continues to develop. I mean, we've in these post-game sessions, we've had a number of charts talking through the way the S&P has been developing all year long. On this first chart, I just put that 50-day exponential moving average on there. And basically, every correction this year has more or less found immediate support support on the 50-day moving average, reversed and began a new bull run on the upside. And it just like clockwork, we had, you know, a 50%+ retracement of the prior advance in the market, hits right into that 50-day and bounces. And it's going to be really curious as to whether this is enough for the bulls to take this market to a higher high, because I want to kind of put some other things into perspective than just what may obviously be this perception that there was a buying opportunity that just occurred a day ago. So the first thing I want to highlight is that if we go on page 3, I just circled a couple sequences in the middle of market corrections. And again, I want to emphasize corrections. We're not talking bear markets and crashes and things like that. But often when the first wave of selling comes into a market like I've circled here, often you're going to get this reflexive snapback rally. And in the past, those rallies last about 48 hours. And what usually will happen afterwards is the market will re-resume and go back and continue correcting downwards to establish a new base from which a rally will begin. And I think it's actually a really important moment on the S&P 500. Now that we're 2 days off of the low, will the bulls make this stick, or will this roll over again for another wave of correction on the downside? But it in order to kind of give us clues as to how that is developing, I have a couple other interesting charts. So first of all, I wanted to highlight on page 4 the relative sector performance in the markets. And obviously, the energy sector has had an awful run as the cyclicals are being rotated out of. And it's interesting, crude oil, where it is, this type of a material underperformance of this sector is a bit surprising that it's this deep. But again, beyond the technology, the areas and sectors that have continued to do well are the defensive-oriented ones, healthcare, communications, utilities, and retail. Held up, and it really tends to be a lot more of the cyclical ones like basic materials and financials that continue to contribute to the weakness. But what I also thought was really interesting was the extreme readings we're seeing on a lot of breadth or sentiment indicators. And so one of the things that Eric, that we put on before was the number of a percentage of stocks in the New York Stock Exchange that were trading above their 50-day moving averages. Well, this reading earlier in the week hit pretty close to 25. And what was really interesting about that is that if you go back and look at the last 3 years of markets beyond the kind of more ominous 20%+ market drops that we had, every time the market has gotten this oversold on based on this kind of metric, it led to a buying opportunity. But what's amazing is that the S&P 500 is not even 1% off of its highs. And so these readings are almost reading as though there were these extreme downside moves and this correction was so robust. But yet, from an index perspective, there is no sign of that correction. And that is obviously a lot to do with the breadth and the leadership and the fangs that we've highlighted in the past. But it's not just the readings like this. If we go to page 6 here, where I have that CNN Fear Greed Index, we are, based on their readings, at 24, which is a rating of in the extreme fear category, this having been down into the teens just earlier in the week. Again, we're a situation where we're less than a percent off the highs, but from a fear greed index perspective of the way that they calculate this, we seem to have very negative or extreme sentiment towards the market, like if the sky was falling. And I'm spending a lot of time trying to reflect how we can have such divergent readings on these things versus the index. And, you know, it really asks the question as to whether there is still something more ominous coming for the stock market, or is it really just going to be able to brush all of this off and just re-resume in bullish fashion?
Well, and if you really look at what this chart is telling you, Patrick, it says that maybe there's a setup for a launch from here, a melt-up to much higher numbers. And believe me, I don't think that those valuations make any sense, but the crack-up boom narrative does make sense, and that could explain maybe a coming big move, because we're at a sentiment extreme that should be a setup for a big move up in prices, shouldn't it?
Well, you know what? I certainly don't want to rule out the possibility that that becomes the unfolding reality. But my speculation is that it's entirely possible that the summer ends up being far more range bound, with so many cross currents and so many different things, that with the, many of these, the FANG leadership stocks being so overbought, some of these other sectors simply not rotating. Like if Darius is right and there continues to be a disinflationary rotation, then the things that are most oversold are not imminently going to start rallying. Maybe they will months from now, but maybe the stock market may be far more in a topping formation where, you know, 4,400 or in that zone ends up being the high and the market just chops sideways for the rest of the summer. You know, we're going to continue to give everyone updates here week in and week out to kind of see how this develops, but it really is interesting. You know, I've been watching charts for 20 plus years and I don't remember a market with this kind of divergence in it, and it'll be really interesting to see how this plays out.
Patrick, let's move on to a subject that I've been musing on for years now, which is junk bonds and the credit spread. And we've got page 7 here. What's this chart telling us?
So what's interesting is that the way that bonds have traded all year, like when we're talking treasury bonds, they've gone through a horrible decline and then a rally. But junk bonds, because they're shorter in duration and much more correlated to equity, seem to have weathered the storm very well in a period where many categorize as a bit of a bond bear market that occurred earlier. But what we saw earlier in the week was the first legitimate kind of fear spike in credit spreads. We saw credit spreads rise from just slightly above 3%, about 3.5% on the OAS credit spread reading, which is the differential between treasury and the yields on these junk bonds. But just like the stock market, it quickly brushed it off and heading to the highs. And it's interesting, but these junk bonds continue to trade more and more like the stock market and less like the bond market. And it'll be interesting to see whether or not that correlation to the equities continues.
Patrick, let's talk bond yields on the 10-year treasury. What's going on here?
Well, you know, you were talking about this in the market wrap at the beginning. What I did is I overlaid the 50-day moving average, not for a predictive factor, but it was simply to as an identifier of trend. And what we clearly have is a sequence where yields continue to make lower lows and lower highs, which is the reverse for what bonds are currently doing. And this trend seems to be persistent. And obviously, you know, Darius was also talking about this idea of disinflationary pressures. But really, it'll be interesting to see whether every one of these rallies gets faded and whether we go even test 1% in the coming weeks. It's certainly one of the top things that I'm watching at this stage.
Do you think we've got a chance of new lows? I forget what the actual low is, with 35 basis points or something?
Oh, I don't know whether I want to be bold enough to say that, but we certainly, at this stage, though, the reflation trade and that bond bear that was running so rampantly since from November to March, that has clearly now rotated. And the question now really is, how low can they take yields and under what circumstances? I think things would have to get pretty dicey for bond yield. Like, there would have to be some serious disinflationary pressures, I think, for bond yields to head that low. I think at this stage, targeting 1% is a much more realistic technical target. And then if it turns into something more, we'll have to call the play-by-play then.
Let's move on to my favorite chart on page 9, which is crude oil futures. Now, we don't have the moving averages on this particular chart, but that last move down was a pretty significant one, because since November, we really haven't seen any sustained move below the 55-day moving average. This one took us right down to a good clean test of the 100-day. I'm not that worried about it. I think people just panicked, but you know, on a technical level, this could be the end of a dead cat bounce. We could be headed back down. What do you make of this?
I'm not opposed to your view. The way that I kind of look at it, just observing back in March and in April through May, crude oil made substantial highs along the $65 level, just rounding that area to 65. And this entire pullback that happened in the span of this last week basically came and tested that $65 level. But more importantly, when looking at the entire advance since the first quarter, this this was more or less a 50% retracement of that prior rise. And so it fits all of the criteria of a typical market correction. And really, I think the evidence to me that we're going to be looking for in the coming week is, will the bulls be able to get this legitimately above this kind of $70 to $72 level? And if we start getting back to $75, not only does that neutralize all the selling pressure and start to repair the chart considerably, but it really puts the launching pad there in play for a move up to that $80, $85 level, which could entirely happen. I'm not ready to be fully bullish on crude, but certainly a key technical level was tested. And if the bulls can really follow through on the strength of the last 2 days, the chart can definitely start to get bullisher.
Patrick, we talked about the U.S. dollar index and the market rep, but let's look at the Euro-U.S. dollar cross, because that really is the most influential in the dollar index. And boy, on page 10, we've got a chart. Looks like we're in the red again. What does the red mean?
Well, you know what? All I just wanted to do is highlight the supports that occurred on the Euro-U.S. dollar. And we're approaching that. And so while the U.S. dollar strength has been very pronounced over the last 2 months, we're approaching some very key levels. So to me, I don't see the asymmetry of pressing U.S. dollar longs into that kind of resistance, or in this case, euro shorts into this kind of support. And I think at this moment, we should watch and see how the bears react in this along these key levels before making another high conviction call on the currency.
Now, on page 11, Patrick, is this a mistake on the chart? Because I read on Wall Street Bets that silver had to go by the 4th of July to over $1,000 an ounce.
That is a bold forecast, Eric. But in this circumstance, I think the only way to define silver really for the last year has been a considerable sideways consolidation. And with the recent drop last week, we are slowly, like a stone's throw away from some very key supports. No, not much different than the way the euro is approaching supports. And really, while that doesn't necessarily have to make an immediate bull case for silver, every time you approach key supports like that, it becomes a tactical place where you can find asymmetry in terms of attempting in a long position. And so as silver is weakening into these supports, so it's going to be really interesting to see whether or not it presents a buying opportunity to take advantage of it along a key support line.
Listeners, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every day of the week by signing up for a free trial at bigpicturetrading.com. Information's on page 12 or at bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for this week's show.
This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective, because the funds sit in escrow.
Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as the link to Darius's slide deck, as well as the chart book we just discussed here in the post game. There's also a link to a Jesse Felder article, The Triumph of Hope Over Experience, and a Charlie McElligott update on This Is How Overpositioning Tips Over. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, that's Eric spelled with a K, and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.